Morning, Mr. Dwight.
Sorry, morning, sir. All and well, and you?
Good. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. Good luck with the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Dwight. Colleagues, can I please assist Rehati Dev to properly capture him or her? Can you please introduce himself or herself? Rehati Dev, can you please introduce yourself? Rehadi, can you please introduce yourself? Okay, unfortunately, I will have to remove this person from the meeting. Thank you. Hi, Estee. Hello, Estee.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, and yourself?
Thank you.
Great. Earlier on, I invited this account, Rehad Dev, to introduce him or herself, and it was silent. After three calls, I removed this account. So I don't know
Oh.
if he or she is willing to say something so that we can rename it properly. Rehadi Dev, can you please say something? Please give us your proper name. Rakhadi Dev, can you please assist us?
Good morning. Yes, I'm on it. I'm on it right now. Thank you.
Can you please introduce yourself, sir, so that we can assist you?
Hi, sir. Okay, we are YouTube streaming, sir.
YouTube streaming from where, Minir?
From Rakhadi.
What is Rakhadi? Can you please introduce it? Rakhadi, can you please explain yourself, please? Rakhadi, I did not send an invite to you. Can you please give us more information before I remove this account from the meeting? Has the account disappeared now, Esti?
It looks like it. Looks like they left the meeting.
Okay.
Or did you remove them?
No, I did not. Okay. Let's not accept that account again because we don't have any information about it. Thank you.
Okay.
Recording in progress.
Hello, Chairperson.
Hi, Lubabalo. I just want to check who you're referring to, because Tikeledi phoned me last night and she said she's not well, and she clearly isn't. And she said that she would notify me about 15 minutes before the meeting whether she can or can't chair. Is she chairing or not?
As far as I know, you are chairing, Chairperson. So I was calling you, Chairperson.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm not the only chairperson. There's about 80 in the parliament, which alone tells you how. All right, I don't want to go there. My views on Parliament and the way it functions is irrelevant. All right, so I'm chairing for what it's worth, and Lubabalo, you'll guide me. But as I understand it, the meetings here are slightly different from the way we function, so I'm not sure, whether I'm doing it okay. So you are free to intervene and guide me, because I must do what the Appropriations Committee does. So very quickly, opening and welcome. Well, I don't have much to say, except to welcome everybody, in particular National Treasury, who's here on the two bills before us. And as I understand it, we've got at least one obvious apology, which comes from our chairperson, who we must convey good wishes to for a speedy recovery. We're very sorry she's not well. Secondly, are there any other apologies you have, my friend?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, and the honorable members and colleagues on the platform. Yes, there are two more apologies, an apology from Honorable Ryder and Honorable Mama Rakgane. Thank you.
Yeah, so Mama Rakgane, not well as well. And then Dennis is somewhere in Germany, I think, for some study tour of the Defense, Joint Defense Committee. Yeah, okay, good. Both are legitimate apologies. We then move on to responses by National Treasury on public submissions. First, we'll deal with the appropriation bill and then the ESCOM debt relief. We got the PowerPoint presentation yesterday. I just want to ask Lubabalo, let me ask them actually. It's a question that, is really for the committee to decide. So as far as I can tell, Treasury, how much time would you need? Is 45 minutes okay, or do you want an hour since there are two bills? How much time would you want? Who's leading the team?
Good morning, Chairperson. This is Mampo Modise. I will be leading the team. I think 45 minutes will be sufficient for us.
Okay, let's go for it. We all got the PowerPoint presentation. I browsed through it this morning in anticipation I might have to chair. And in any case, I catch up during meetings. But when you're a chair, you have to be more, prepared. So I regret, committee members, you know this full well. I couldn't be here last week. For the reasons that I've already explained in the chat group, right? And while I'm with you, I need to tell you the Finance Committee next week also, I'm taking part in some conference in KZN, and I won't be here for next week. Either Zolani and Kiba will be chairing a public hearing on Tuesday. But these are all approved or about to be approved by the Chief Whip, and that is part of my social and broader political responsibilities. Okay, shall we go on then? Over to you, Treasury.
I'm here. Thank you so much. As I said, this is Mampo Modise, and I hope Lubabalo can slide the presentation for us. So basically, we have collected most of the recommendations and noted the submissions that were made by the different stakeholders. And what we have here, Chairperson and honorable members, is just to summarize those responses. And I will be joined with my chief directors in public finance and in the budget office. They will introduce themselves as they respond. And then once we finish public finance with the appropriation bill, then the team from asset and liability management.
Yes, go ahead, please. Are you there, Mampo?
There were recommendations that were additional budget requests. Chair, can I go ahead?
Yes, please do. I don't intervene. I mean, you just go ahead and manage your team. And then when you finish the first one, colleagues, can we get some advice here? Do we want to treat them separately or deal with them both together? What's the advice for members? I don't have a strong view on it. Who's saying what? Any hands up, Lubabalo?
Yes, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson, and members. I think it will be better to deal with one bill at a time because they are not interrelated.
Right. Yeah, I also agree with that. Okay, no, I agree with that. You're right. Let's go ahead. Nobody's saying anything otherwise. Good. Let's go ahead, please.
Yeah, so basically the first set of recommendations were recommendations on additional budget allocations, and that was mainly for the presidential unit interventions, additional funding for the departments that experienced some of the financial pressures, especially for programs that have been underfunded in the past. There were also recommendations on accountability by different departments, and also there has been a lot of comments on corruption and wasteful expenditure and what we're doing with it. So basically, most of the recommendations on the budget process or on the additional funding will definitely incorporate those recommendations when we run the budget process that's going to start next month or tomorrow in June. And basically, we will be presenting those recommendations together with other contributions that we will get from departments to Mincombat and to Cabinet. And the outcome of that process will then be presented by the Minister in October. The accountability of departments, I think we note the recommendations, and of course we support the committees to ensure oversight and hold departments responsible. And on corruption and wasteful expenditure, Dr. Renani will give the committee a flavor of the allocations that we proposing and that Parliament has, we basically putting in the bill for your consideration so that you can at least have a feel of the proposed allocations to try and fight corruption and to capacitate the different institutions that are responsible for dealing with corruption. So, Chairperson, let me ask Marumu to quickly just go through the recommendations or the responses by National Treasury on the wage agreement. Marumu, are you there?
Yes, Dr. Mampo, and good morning to the Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, the colleagues, and any other persons that are on the platform. My name is Marumo Mage from the Treasury. As Dr. Mampo has already indicated, I'll take the submissions relating to the wages and remunerations and headcounts. The first submission was in relation to the suggestion that was made that perhaps there is a need for a single wage regime as well as collective bargaining processes for national provinces, SOEs and entities. And as a response, as a treasury, I mean, we are in an agreement in principles, but perhaps, I mean, we are saying that the issue is not much about bringing all these entities and national and provinces into a single bargaining process, but rather the need for the realignment of the mandating processes at a state level, I mean, to ensure that the manner in which we deal with the salaries with wages and wage increases, I mean, becomes fair and equitable across all levels or all institutions of the state. So I think, I mean, we are in agreement, but with the issues of aligning the mandating processes. And in terms of the single wage regime, I mean, we are also in agreement that, I mean, perhaps, I mean, we need to review the entire public sector remuneration, I think, which is a project that is currently underway and led by the DPSA, and with the view or the idea that the state should move to a single public sector remuneration framework, I mean, that will regulate all government employees and ensure that, I mean, there is fairness in the manner in which the public servants in general are remunerated. So that work is led by the DPSA. It's ongoing. They are doing it in phases. And I think once it's concluded, I mean, we'll be able to get a much better view and guidance in terms of how we can move with this process. And the idea there is to target the state-owned entities that rely mainly on transfers from the state. So that process is currently underway, and it will be able to guide us to designing this new remuneration framework. And then the other suggestion or the other view that was submitted was that we should reduce the packages of politicians as well as the managers in the public sector. And I must say, in principle, as the Treasury, I mean, we agree with all suggestions or views or initiatives that have been submitted to us that will be able to help us realize savings as well as and help in managing the sustainability of our public finances. I mean, but I must indicate that some of these things, I mean, comes with their own complexities. I mean, they are not as easy as they are presented. I mean, I will start with the remunerations of politicians. I mean, Treasury has got no jurisdictions over the wage settings of public office bearers, including political office bearers. I mean, because that is managed in terms of 219 of the constitutions, which requires that legislation be passed, and that legislation must establish an independent commission. I mean, that must do its research and make recommendations on those remunerations. And that commission currently does exist, which is the independent commission for remuneration of public office bearers. And the commission makes recommendations to the presidents concerning those salaries and allowances. And as a treasurer, we participate because the commission does consult with the Minister of Finance. I mean, we does participate through that process by expressing our views in terms of the proposals that they are making. And also, once the commission made the submission to the president also does consult with the Minister of Finance, and we also make our view in terms of those processes. But it's not an area where we could just say we agree and we go and reduce the salary of politicians, because we don't really have jurisdiction over that. In terms of other benefits, I mean, currently the ministerial handbook, I think the president ordered that it should be reviewed, and the DPSA is leading that process. And as the National Treasury, I mean, our role there is to determine the price threshold of official vehicles. And I must indicate that, I mean, since 2019, I mean, we've managed to keep that price constant as a way of managing and restricting expenditure relating to those benefits. And we've put in place transversal contracts to ensure that the 800,000could still be applicable and in buying some of those cars that are suitable for the executive. So that is our main role as far as this space is concerned. Then in terms of the managers, I mean, as I said, I mean, we do agree with any initiatives that will result in us realizing some savings. But I must indicate that even with regard to the salaries of managers, I mean, it will not be easy to just go and reduce the salaries of senior managers in the public service, in local government, and then also even in entities without looking at the entire remuneration framework, because the salaries are interlinked to each other. I mean, the salaries of the managers are interlinked to the salaries of the non-senior managers. I mean, if I can give an example, in the public service, I mean, the gap between the salary of a level 12, which is a non-senior manager, and a level 13, which is the starting point of the senior managers, the gap is not that huge. So meaning that if we go and reduce the salaries of a director, the chances are that, in fact, not the chances, I mean, then the salaries will get to a position where the salaries of deputy directors will overshoot, and overlap those of the directors. In fact, I think in the local government space, we did find ourselves in that position where we were even forced to go and review the salaries of senior managers in certain categories, because the bargain council employees' salaries have been increasing at a higher rate than that of the senior managers. And consequently, what happened is that then there was that overlapping that we started experiencing. So as much as we agree with this recommendation, but the recommendation will have far-reaching consequences for the entire remuneration structures, meaning that we'll have to go back to even the bargain council and start there and negotiate with the unions for this reduction before you even think about reducing the packages of the senior managers on the other side. Then moving on to the next submission. There was also a submission that we should do a physical headcount to identify ghost employees. I think we do agree with this initiative. And in fact, we've already engaged with our counterparts, DPSA, that perhaps such a project should be initiated where we go through a personal cleanup and try to ensure that all employees that are on the system can be able to be accounted for. But I must indicate that, I mean, a project of this or an initiative of this nature has been implemented in the past by some provinces. KZN did it in education, Limpopo. During the time of Section 100, it was done in health and education through State SA. I think in Gauteng, they did introduce some initiative, biometrics initiative in health, to try and make sure that everyone is accounted for. And I must indicate that, I mean, it doesn't seem like there were major problems that were detected there. So I don't think there were a lot of people that were identified as ghosts, I mean, from this process. But I think, yeah, we take the recommendation, and we will try and see if whether, I mean, we can implement it in the medium to long term and ensure that, I mean, we are able to account for each and every person that is on the system. I think those were the questions, Chair and Dr. Mampo. Thank you. I'll move on. I'll hand over to my next colleague. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. It's Randani here. I will take you through those issues which were directed to the Justice and Protection Services cluster. Let me start with the issues raised by the Public Service Accountability Monitor. And the first one, it was a question as to whether funds can be reallocated within the justice vote to ensure adequate resourcing of anti-corruption system. Yes, that's the spirit of our budget process, that reprioritization where possible should be done. For example, in the current budget tabled in February, that 33 million was reprioritized towards the implementation of the FATF recommendation to be implemented by the FIC. In addition, 1.3 billion was also allocated to the NPA for the implementation of State Capture Commission recommendations, FATF included in there. In our last engagement, Honorable Ockham asked about funding allocated for the specialized prosecutors from the private sector to deal with complex cases. Out of that 1.3 billion, 750 million is for those prosecutors. We call them Section 38 in terms of the NPA Act. And the second recommendation by the Public Service Accountability Monitor was for the committees to compel National Treasury to review the SIU, the Special Investigating Unit funding model, to ensure it is fully funded and able to deliver on its mandate. We have been engaging with the SIU. We have considered several options, one of which is this one recommended by the Public Service Accountability Monitor. And we came to the conclusion that the current funding model, which is a hybrid model, which is a combination of the appropriation and the fee that they charge to the client's department that they investigate, we support the current funding model. And again, it must be noted that at the end of March 22, the National Treasury approved that an amount of 921 million can be retained by the Special Investigating Unit, especially to deal with the cash flow challenges that they experienced during the course of the year. And linked to that, this current budget made a recommendation that 100 million be allocated to the SIU for the implementation of state capture commission recommendation. And the other recommendation by the Public Service Accountability Monitor was that given underspending by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, funds should be reallocated to the SIU. And considering that we have approved that almost $1 billion can be retained by the Special Investigating Unit. From where we are sitting for now, we don't see any pressures. However, there's an option that should savings be realized on the justice vote and SIU is in need of funding. There's a legal provision that allows for the increase of the transfer payments to the SIU. And the other recommendation by the Public Service Accountability Monitor was that the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council should receive adequate funding to ensure sustainability. We note the recommendation. However, it should be noted that the bulk of the work is done by the relevant government department responsible for the implementation of the various pillars of the National Anti-Corruption Strategy. In addition, these are early days, because this advisory council was appointed sometimes last year in August and we haven't been engaged, but should the need arise, hopefully the presidency will engage us and then it will be dealt with as part of the budget process going forward. Next slide. And lastly, there was the issue of police numbers. The concern that the headcount decline is declining from 208 to 172 personnel. It must be noted that the current budget as tabled provides 7.8 billion in the next 3 years for the appointment of 15,000 police personnel. I think I should also clarify that in the current financial year, 10,000 will be trained and ultimately absorbed. The other 5,000 it's coming from the previous allocation, which was done in the 2022 MTF. I think this concludes my inputs. I will now hand over to my colleague, Julia, to deal with the issues raised.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'm dealing with education and related sectors. There were three issues raised at the hearing. The first one from Equal Education, that the National Treasury should adopt a human rights approach to budgeting that prioritizes socioeconomic rights like basic education. Over 60% of total non-interest spending is allocated over the MTF to the social wage. So that's 60% of the total budget that is includes both national and provinces for community development, employment programs, health, education, and social protection. So this is indeed an indication that the budget does prioritize socioeconomic issues. There was a question, I think, from, two members of the Standing Committee, of the Select Committee on Appropriation, that spoke to why is higher education allocated three times as much as basic education. The appropriation bill, Honourable Members, only reflects the proposed allocation to national departments. So it is true that higher education is allocated almost three times. Its allocation is 110.8 billion, whereas that of the National Department of Basic Education is 31.8 billion. But basic education is mainly delivered by the 9 provincial departments of basic education. And if you add up their budgets, you get a total proposed allocation of 277.8 billion for 23-24. However, the point that the honorable members made was also in relation to spending per learner. So in the higher education sector, it's roughly about 64,800 per student, which is more or less three times that, more than that of basic education, which is around 22,000. But members will appreciate that it costs a lot more to train a doctor, an engineer, or a motor mechanic than it would to run a school program. So it's not unusual that the cost should be higher. Kasatu raised a whole range of issues that around increasing allocations. One of them, which falls in this portfolio, is the CCMA. They indicated that the CCMA is struggling with case backlogs, yet its budget has not increased much to keep up with the increased demand. This has been a recommendation in previous years and in the previous MTF, the 2022 MTF, an additional 120 million was allocated to the CCMA to help with the increasing caseload. For the information of the members, the proposed transfer to the CCMA for 2023-24 is 1.05 billion rand. Thanks.
So good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. This is Ulrika Britton. I'll be taking you through some of the built environment issues and network industry issues that was raised in the public consultation
group. Sorry, can I just ask, are you quite distant from the mic? Because it's like you're in a basement, you know. I'm sure
no, exactly.
It's like a slight echo. Okay, slightly better. Let's go for it. I mean, it's not your fault. Yeah, okay.
So the issue that was raised in relation to my classes don't directly relate to the bill, but they do have broader fiscal implications. So the first one was raised by Kasatu in relation to the road accident benefit scheme. We support this proposal that the bill is retabled, Chair, just simply because the policy proposals around the road accident benefit scheme shift the kind of the broader fundamental from a liability insurance scheme to one that is based on social security principles that we hope would allow for a more equitable, a more affordable, and a more sustainable mechanism to support road accident victims. In relation to the recapitalization of state-owned companies, one of the key requirements that we have for departments to motivate for funding for state-owned companies is that we have a turnaround plan. The reason why kind of these entities find themselves in difficult financial positions would be because their costs exceed their revenue, which means that they run into some kind of operating deficit, and if they don't have surpluses to finance those deficits, they become they go into financial distress. But turnaround plan also means that we have to look at strategies to review costs and the cost structure and whether that cost structure is uncompetitive and how we are able to streamline and increase revenue to improve profitability that would reduce their reliance on the fiscus. But sometimes it does mean that things like organizational restructuring needs to take place and where access does exist, that gets rationalized. And if we want to put our state-owned companies on a sustainable path, we have to allow them to do so. So this is really just in relation to, so for example, the post office, where part of the turnaround plan is that they would have to re-change people. But on the one hand, we say that we shouldn't allow them to do that. But by keeping that on means that when your business doesn't allow for this, you become inefficient and you don't remain profitable. With that also, it then also means that the reliance on the fiscus would then continue into the future. The SSC and Youth Capital both raise issues around expanding infrastructure investment. So we have the consolidated, including public state-owned companies. We have about 900 billion rand worth of infrastructure investment that we expect to happen over the 2023 MTF. But the largest of that, of course, would be on the balance sheets of Eskom and Transnet. One of the key pillars of why we think that these investments are important relates to economic infrastructure that not only helps with increasing aggregate demand in the short term, so during construction, but also improves the supply side capacity in the economy. So by having and a better performing harbors and functioning road a functioning road network and a functioning rail system means that increased productivity from farms and factories are able to then get to the harbor and then get to markets. That's really the economic benefit of over the long term, and our infrastructure investments lie into that. The FSC was particularly concerned around the declining shares of local government and provincial government capital investment as a percentage of total capital investment by the public sector. And we should all be worried about that. So some of the fastest growing expenditure items in the budget relate to transfers that we do make to provinces and municipalities. I mean, the local government equitable share is one of the fastest growing expenditure items that we have in the budget, and yet we see this declining spend on fixed investment. It does suggest that there is a shift from capital to operations. We see that in provinces too. The largest provincial spending on the CapEx is in provincial roads, where that is supplemented through the provincial road maintenance grant. But so what we're seeing is that provinces are not spending as much as they should be, or that there are other operational pressures within provincial and local government budgets that are seeing a decline in capital expenditure in those areas. For municipalities, it's particularly concerning given that these are tradable services where matters related to the pricing of water and sanitation services, electricity services, does help finance and does provide for sustainable financing mechanism over the life to do all of this. I think that's all from me. Thank you, Chairperson.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. My name is Gillian Wilson, Chief Director of Public Finance, responsible for Administrative Services Department. I just want to raise a few issues that was raised by Kosatu regarding Home Affairs. The first issue that was raised is there's a reduction in the baseline of 0.8%. in the baseline of the department, and that could impact on service delivery. They also raised a concern around the lack of staff to deliver frontline services. As our response, there were no reduction in the baseline of Home Affairs. We did a function shift from the department's baseline to the Border Management Authority. The Border Management Authority was incubated in the department for 3 years prior to the entity becoming independent. So the Border Management Authority was established as an independent entity on 1st April 2023. There was also a concern raised around the funding available for political parties, the lack of funding. That's there. Our response is that political parties receive funding from Parliament for constituency work in various areas. There's also funds in the provinces that political parties can access. There's a multi-party democracy fund administered by the IEC, but did not have any success to attract funding from the private sector. We also have a baseline for political parties also in the IEC, and we assess that baseline on a continuous basis. So we will also do so to see during this intake whether there's a shortfall in the funding for political parties. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bumbo, who's back? Okay. Oh, there we are. Okay, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Leboha Madiba. I'm from the National Treasury. I'm the Chief Director for Economic Services. I'm responsible for budget-related matters for departments in the economic cluster, amongst others. There were questions from two stakeholders, which are COSATU and which are COSATU and Youth Capital. So the question from the three questions from COSATU, the first one being that government needs to provide assurance that the government owned money to workers at Denel will now be paid. We can safely confirm that all the outstanding salaries that were owed to employees of Denel were paid off by the end of October 2022, after Denel realized about 992 million from the Denel Medical Benefit Trust. Another question from COSATU was that more needs to be done by law enforcement to protect the railway infrastructure. As government, we are already collaborating with Transnet as part of the protection of critical infrastructure strategy. Transnet has also developed partnerships with the private sector to address cable theft and vandalism on the freight rail network through the use of advanced technologies and additional security personnel. In 2020, government announced measures targeted at restricting trade in scrap metal to limit damage to public infrastructure. One of the recommendations proposed the establishment of a metal trade task force that will work with sub-specialized multidisciplinary economic infrastructure task team. Further to say is that Critical Infrastructure Protection Act number 8 of 2019, amongst other, provides for measures to be put in place for the protection, safeguarding and resilience of critical infrastructure. It also establishes the Critical Infrastructure Council, comprising of the Department of Defense, Department of Home Affairs, Department of Public Works, National Disaster Management Center, South African Local Government Association, and the South African Police and the State Security Agency. There's also the National Rail Crime Combating Forum, which assists government to cap cable theft and infrastructure vandalism. The Department of Public Enterprise has signed the Memorandum of Understanding with relevant state-owned enterprises to implement interventions that will assist in dealing with the impact caused by the theft, vandalism, and trade in ferrous and non-ferrous metal waste as scrap. Another question from COSATU related to the need for Treasury to support ESCOM to reduce wasteful expenditure. We are working closely with ESCOM and DPE to reduce wasteful expenditure. We are having monthly meetings with DPE and ESCOM, you know, to discuss financial related matters. But also safely to say that on a weekly basis, ESCOM is sending to us their weekly cash flow projections as part of our oversight, financial oversight as the National Treasury. In terms of the question from Youth Capital, the first question being that government must increase the annual industrial financing budget to 2.5% of GDP, with 1% directed towards SMMEs. We can safely say that over the 2023 MTF, the DTIC has budgeted 18.9 billion towards various business incentives program. This incentive includes support towards SMMEs. We are also supporting SMMEs through a township and a rural entrepreneur program implemented via CIFA, which is meant to support businesses in townships and rural areas, which has been allocated 2.8 billion over the MTF. As government, we are also supporting SMMEs through a blended finance program meant to subsidize SMMEs to acquire private sector funding, which we have allocated so far 4.1 billion over the MTF. We are also providing significant tax support to businesses as part of the COVID relief measures, for instance, you know, considering the fact that our SMMEs are the backbone to our economy and that we want to encourage and support them to ensure that they grow and that they prosper. We together with SARS as the National Treasury, introduced certain tax measures designed to support these SMMEs and small businesses, where for instance, if you know the annual turnover is up to 79,000 per annum, the small business is not eligible to pay checks, for instance. I can also safely say that over the medium term, we have supported the Department of Small Business Development with an amount of 2.6 billion in 2023-24, 2.7 billion in 24-25, and 2.8 billion in 25-26 as part of the funding that should that's supposed to go towards SMME. And CEDA, Small Enterprise Development Agency, is allocated 2.7 billion towards all of its operations as far as support towards SMME is concerned. And through CEDA, we continue to promote business competitiveness, viability, and localization with a particular focus on the development of township, rural, and informal business and startups by facilitating the support, supporting establishment of about 250 businesses incubators over the period ahead. This will be funded by allocations amounting to 503 million over the MTF, complemented by private sector funding. Another question from the youth capital was that government should introduce lending targets or quotas for bank lending to labor-intensive sectors and black SMEs. And that a third of the DFI disbursement must be funded or must go to the youth-owned enterprises. While at the moment we don't have a policy position in terms of imposing bank lending quotas, but as government, we are collaborating with private sector to support the industrial policy, among others. We have master plan, we have the loan guarantee scheme, we have the Black Industrialist Program in the IDC, but also we're working with the SAP and the commercial banks and the IDC in terms of the bounce back scheme. So far, we have set aside 8 billion for this purpose, particularly to support SME with energy solutions. That should be all from my side, Chair. Thank you very much.
Pompo, who's next, please?
Thank you, Chairperson. Those would be the responses that we have for the appropriations bill.
Okay. Very quickly then, colleagues, questions, comments? Lubavalo, can you help me, please? Mr. Jitoy.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. If you'd excuse my video.
Sure.
That's good. I am here. Honorable Chair, I don't know if this is the correct platform, but it has to do with appropriations bill. I want to find out, something has been bothering me for a while in terms of the appropriations. Is what criteria or principles are used to determine whether an appropriation is or will be classified as an expenditure in the accounting system, transactions and assets and liabilities, or as a Section 70 of the Public Finance Management Act payment? Because this year an amount of 1.97 billion is appropriated to the National Treasury budget, which provides for the recapitalization of the Agricultural Development Bank of South Africa. It's about 1 billion, as well as the World Bank for 278.3 million and the African Development Bank and African Development Fund at 638.9 million. Now, the previous appropriations for transactions, assets and liabilities are now reflected as Section 70 of the PFMA transactions in the estimate of the national expenditure. If that can just be clarified, I'll put this question in the chat as well, Chair. I think it would assist National Treasury.
Thank you. Next, thank Willie.
You. Morning, Chair. Thank you for the presentations. Chair, yeah, I would just like to get clarity with regards to the money available for private legal practitioners to assist the Directorate of Public Prosecutions. I did not get that amount. Maybe there was a problem with my sound, but it brings us back to the question that we need to empower the Directorate of Public Prosecutions so that they can really get specialist prosecutors in that can assist with regards to the outcomes of the Sonderkommission and with prosecutions that they know that really sometimes require absolute specialist people that can really prosecute those matters thoroughly. So if I can just get clarity on that amount again, I would appreciate it. Chairperson, then again, just to come back to the difference in the budget for basic education and higher education. We are sitting in our country with far more learners at school than we've got people at university. So you see that in the amount per student, 64,800 per student versus 22,000 per learner at school. I really think that we've got a huge challenge in this country to get pupils at school more funding, to really make sure that we form this base of people that can get a good basic education. It will, in the long run, help us to have more students going over to university. But I'm really very concerned that we are not putting enough money into basic education. Last week, we got the stats of students or pupils in grade four that are capable of reading with meaning. That are worrying figures, and the reason for that is because we are not putting enough into basic education. And I think it's very important that we really, in the short term, but especially in the long term, look at solutions for that problem. Otherwise, we will have a skewed education system. We will have a lot of dropouts, as we saw in the past. Every year we get the matric results, but we do not take into consideration how many of those pupils that started in grade one eventually ended up completing and obtaining their matric certificate. So I think it's very important that we really look at that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Anybody else? I don't see any other hand up. Bulubabalo, I don't. Do you?
No, Chairperson, except...
Simon Molitsane, do you got anything to say, my friend? No? All right. Look, basically, can I just raise a few quick questions, right? So firstly,
nothing to say, Chairperson, today.
Aye, wow. EFF has got nothing to say. Oh, that's shocking and traumatized, but we can talk about that some other time. The enumeration issue, right? So obviously, it doesn't reflect on the current relatively young members of the Treasury Department who are here, the officials. It's more reflection on us politicians, us in particular in the ruling party. But this issue came up in 19... Look, I don't remember, Lou Balo, colleagues, comrades. But my sense is it came up when I was chairing local government. So either just before the 99 election or sometime early 2000s, when Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi was the Minister of Public Service and Administration, that we need to rationalize the public service across three spheres and look at, applying general remuneration and also move people from one sphere to the other as may be needed. One of the issues that propelled that was actually a feeling that more and more we need very skilled managers at local government level, given its crucial importance in service delivery. And we could move provincial and national managers to local government and vice versa. And that was what? Over 20 years ago, at least. Listening to Treasury now, and I don't mean to reflect on the input we got from Treasury today, it's not about them, it's about us, especially as old politicians here. Actually, it was nothing new with the set. It was almost presented as if it's like a recent project, right? But actually, it's over 20 years old. Maybe it's an unfair question, Mambu, to you and your team, but what is new here? What sign is there that there's been any significant progress or when is this process meant to end? I say this bearing in full mind that you need to carry SAMHU and the other unions with you, NIHAU and so on. Public service, what's the other union called? PSU or whatever. Or PSA, I don't know what it's called, I've forgotten. Who is larger than NIHAU, I think, in the public service. So you need to carry the unions with you, the collective bargaining structures with you, make after make changes to legislation, as you pointed out, sir. It's also an issue of labor rights and so on, and people are not going to agree. Link to your second point, to changes in the circumstance. Also, there are huge financial implications, if I recall, Mampu, because you've got scores and scores of senior managers also in the local government municipalities. So I remember those were amongst the issues we dealt with. And every year or two, either within the ANC or ANC conferences and or government or parliamentary briefings, we were told, oh, this matter is going to be resolved. So I'm sorry to say, but, you know, it's astonishing, really, Mampu. It's not about you and your team, please. It's not personal. You know, we are required to exercise oversight. But sometimes one gets restrained, not me personally, but in the way that me, in my case, I choose my words, but diplomatically, you might not accept that, Mampu. But frankly, you know what? We have to do our job, just as you have to do yours. It's not a reflection on you personally, Mampu. I like very much the quality of what you bring, young as you are. And I also am quite impressed that you allocate the way you do to various people to make inputs. That's very good. It's a big team. It can be done virtually. While I say that, can I just draw this to the attention of members as I exit in the next few months? You know, one year, when I was chairing local government, about 12 or 14 people turned up in Cape Town. There was no such thing as Zoom in those days. So in those days, either the DG or DDG spoke. Nobody else spoke. So even as a chair, I don't buy that line. There's nothing in the public service regulations or in the bill, I mean, in the act that says only a senior manager may speak. So I alerted the department officials and the committee. It's wrong. People fly in the night before. They spend, you know, the night in the hotel. Sometimes because meetings carry on for the whole day during committee week period, they stay overnight again and so on. Why is it that so many people come? If the others are not ready to speak, then maybe bring one or two along, I said, and train them. And then bring another one or two and train them. But let them speak. But they would never speak. There's some sort of protocol. I don't know where that comes from. But anyway, come in again. And then I found the minister. And I said, well, we're going to ask you what, what the cost was bringing all these people here. And why is it that only one person speaks? Show us what rule you have in your department or in the public service that doesn't allow it. But with virtual meetings, Mampu, I mean, I don't think we'd have allowed this. I don't think Gikulele would have allowed so many people to come to Cape Town. But with virtual meetings, it can be done. So let me thank you as the leader of the delegation for allowing so many people to speak, exposing us to new faces. I like teasing the DG. Although same would apply to me. Aren't you tired of presenting your face to us with Zoom? And I'm certainly tired of presenting my face to members and, you know, departments. And, you know, you just laugh. But, you know, I really like the demographics of what's here. I like that you're young. I like the quality of what you say. So actually, it's compliments to you, but it's the failure of us politicians and Parliament as a whole and the Public Service Committee in particular and COCTA, whatever the committee was called over the years. Then on the issue, I don't think it's going to happen easily. Again, nothing that's fundamentally new with due respect to Treasury, but of course it's your political office bearers that must take that vote and so must Parliament. And since you brought it to us, now the Appropriations Committee, I'll raise it to my chairperson, has to put this issue on the agenda and push. Before we exit, we want some progress. On the reduction of politicians and managers' remuneration, this too is not particularly new. Politicians is new, but managers is not. Managers is not. I wish you well. I have my strong views about that. You might be surprised what my views are. I think people can pick that up, but I don't carry the majority in my party. And I think you're going to have a fight with politicians and managers. But I wish you well. I don't want to say more about that because it affects us and there are politicians across all parties. Some will do it vocally and others will quietly say it, but, you know, pretend that they are committed to prudence. I know which party in particular I'm referring to. I don't want to raise anybody's hackles, but I've experienced with local government. Let me tell you, Mampu, from the politician side. You see, in a certain municipality, I was once told that a certain party will object to the proposed increases by the MEC framework, and then the municipality will decide. So they'll oppose it, make lots of noise, and then they will go to another party, which is the majority, and they will say, you know what, we've got some financial skills in our caucus. Here's a guy who can assist you with the documents, right? So they will assist in sharpening the internal documents of the municipality, having opposed the increase, proposed increase. So that's how it goes, unfortunately. It cuts across political parties, let me assure you. Some parties more than others. So I wish you well in that regard, but that's not your issue. That's the politician's issue. That's the minister here, the minister of COCTA, the minister of public service, and finally the president. Then on the issue of 1 billion to SIU, I'm glad. You know, I don't know enough, right? But my sense, Pampu and colleagues from Treasury, my sense is they're doing good work, eh? Whether they get the prosecutions or not, I'm not clear about that, but I certainly think they do good work. On the issue of tertiary education, I hear Willie. In some senses, I agree with him. In many senses, I agree with him. You see, I know, Mampu, it's very hard. I mean, my buddy is the Minister of Higher Education, right? And I sometimes get a sense from him in certain structures and also in private conversations. You see, the students bring universities to a halt, and some of the things they do can never, ever be justified. It's borders on nihilism, really. It can't be justified, not from a Marxist view or national democratic view or generally progressive view, not from any view, right? But I can understand the political and other siege that the politicians are at government level and at parliament level, and the terror that the administration, that management, senior academics are under about this. I hear what you're saying about the amount that's allocated, obviously far more, as you said, to train a doctor. Of course I understand. Of course we all understand. But there needs to be a better balance, really. I mean, if we don't get basic education right, all of us across political parties, across the ideological and other spectrums of society know. We are finished. We are doomed. And 29 years later, it's deteriorating. Yes, I think COVID contributes to it. I don't agree that throwing money is the answer. I think it's the quality of the teachers, the new generation in particular. Also, surely, it's the commitment of teachers generally. Also, surely, it's the politicization of teaching to an extreme extent, really. I have never hidden this, and people know it. I once raised with, and I'm not going to detract from it, it's in the public domain, I've said it before. You know, I once asked Mampu, a general secretary of the South African Democratic Teachers Union, in a structure that he and I both served, how is it that you can go on strike in October when you know the matric students are about to write exams? How can you do that, Kim? Why not in June or July? And you're destroying these people's careers. We keep saying we want to deracialize the professions, the economy. How are you going to do it if this goes on? His reply to me was what I anticipated, but I didn't think he would say it. He said, well, that's our bargaining too. If we do it in October near the exams, the authorities, the administration, the government is more likely to concede. If we do it in June, I said, yeah, use those sort of tactics for the private sector, not for the public sector. He wasn't quite convinced. So you know what? It's not about money. I don't think Willie believes that either. It's about the quality of our teachers, the over-politicization of issues. It's, you know, these trade unions that belong to COSATU in particular. They're not just there, as I've repeatedly said, even to Netanyahu leadership, to actually only look at workers' conditions and so on and fight for better conditions. They also play a developmental role by COSATU's policies. They are meant to be oriented. Not every teacher or every public servant, but the ideological orientation is towards socialism. So they have a developmental role. It's not just about wages and working conditions. Of course, they will attack us, and rightly so, for the huge salaries we earn and how committed are we to constituency work and so on, all of which is valid. It doesn't detract from a point. I do think Willie's right. We need to look at a better balance, a more nuanced approach. And finally, we need to take on issues like this, that people are there for 8 years and expecting an asbestos crust. And they think if they march down the corridors of the buildings and in the precinct and then threaten to burn down buildings and so on, then they're entitled to an asbestos crust. Trying to do a BA degree of 8 years, that's not fair to other disadvantaged students. So I really think there needs to be a fuller discussion here, Mampu. It's not for you to have so much as it's for you to prod it as officials, if you agree, that the senior politicians have to have across the government and even the relevant committees in parliament. So you know, I really think despite all the challenges we have, we need to switch the balance. There is a sense in which if we invested more money, we would probably get better quality, but there's no commensurate relationship among the money you invest and what you get out of it. Then on the basic income grant, I don't know that you gave us enough on that. Where is that progress? For example, some years ago, an issue was raised stridently, even in our committee on the National Assembly side. We said repeatedly, Mampu, we're not populists, okay? We're not naive. We're not some people who think we must destroy the budget, knowing how perilous it is anyway, and have some populist measure. But we don't have it, Mampu. You know, there's a strong argument it's worse. The social explosion that's looming is going to be far more consequential economically and financially. And it's looming, eh? Over a variety of issues. We have to have a universal basic income grant. That's the position of this committee, the study group of the ANC. And we've said it in our reports. And there was also this argument, oh, you know, from the government side, we're going through NEDLAC, you know, we are reviewing the entire social grant system. We can't just agree to a UBIG until we've done the whole social grant system. All of which is correct, yes. But where's that progress? How far has that gone? Do you know? It's not your department that's leading that. I think it's the Social Development Department, Minister Lindiwe Zuma's department, but they're working closely with you and other relevant departments. All right, enough from my side. I could raise other issues, but you know what? I think I'm done for too long. Okay, over to you guys. Guys in the plural sense. Who's responding?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Just look at the chat group also when you get a chance, one of you, and just see whether you can kindly reply to that. It's important to reply to the questions there. Go ahead.
Yes, I asked Dr. Blatter to respond on the SRD grant, and I will try and respond to the allocations question. Thank you. Dr. B?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members. I'm not sure if I heard all the questions on the SRD, but let me comment on Chair's last points on the universal basic income grant. Sorry, I just joined from another meeting. So I think it's important to distinguish between what in the literature is called a basic income grant as opposed to some kind of basic income support. And the difference technically in the literature between these is the question of a means test, whether there's a means test or there's not a means test. Now, in the South African context, if you don't have a means test, it means that the grant goes to 36 million people if it's not means tested. Of course, there might be like 90 or 80% uptake on that, but you're talking about, and then you start looking at a cost of like 360 billion a year. And the problem about that is that non-means tested grant, that kind of literature big, which only two countries in the world actually have. It's a very, very rare thing internationally. There are a lot of pilots, but they're actually only two countries in the world that have significantly tried it, and both of them have pulled back substantially. It just becomes completely unaffordable. So let's look at the other option, which is a means-tested grant, a permanent means-tested grant. So a permanent means-tested grant, from our research, would end up going to about 16 to 17 million people. depends a bit exactly where one sets the means test. And based on the current grant, if we brought it to 73% of the food poverty line, it would cost about 130 billion by 2030. So we'd gradually go up from the current 8.6 million people on the SRD grant to about 16 million people over the next 6-7 years. The value would gradually increase from 350 to, well, in that calculation, 70, about 700 rand by 2030. More, obviously, with the food poverty line, because the current 663 would go up. But now, Chairperson, if we do that and we create that permanent SRG grant of 130 billion, that's going to require substantial tax increases. And you know, the finance committee then needs to start thinking about, you know, what are the substantial tax increases that would be required to fund a permanent SRD or permanent basic income support. I mean, you will have some sense, and tax policy colleagues can give you some sense of what is a 1% increase in personal income tax raise, what is a 1% increase in VAT raise, for example. But you can see, if you're talking about 130 billion by 2030, you're talking about a fairly substantial tax increase. But Chair, we will bring proposals to you by the time of the medium-term budget policy statement. But one does need to be aware that, you know, if you want a permanent income grant, this is a major new spending imperative, and it will require fairly major tax increases. I'm not sure if there are other aspects of SRD, Dr. Modise, that I need to cover or not. Thank you.
This is fine, Mark. Thank you. Busi and...
Can I ask a quick question related to this, and maybe other members want to come in on the basic income grant? So obviously the SRD and the basic income grant, as you rightly say, are different, right? Agreed. But one could lead into the other. Secondly, many of the things you say, I don't know the figures you're aware of, and those who are experts in this area who argue for a basic income grant are also very aware of. So there isn't anything new, but, you know, it's important to raise the Treasury's concern because they're also legitimate, okay? And it's just for the committee members who may not know to know this, right? So what I wanted to ask, though, the angle which maybe you answered, Mampu, maybe our friend there doesn't have the answer, I don't know, but at one stage, the government argued that you need to review the entire social grant system, which of course I think is correct, and the president might have said this too once or twice. So where's that process? At one stage, I spoke to a COSATU person, and he said that the discussions are going quite well. Actually, he's here. If I misquote him, then he can say so himself. I'm talking about Matthew, if he doesn't mind. He said that at one stage, unless it's not you, Matthew, but or did I misunderstand you? He said that in net direct, the process is going okay and they're beginning to find each other, something like that. But Matthew, do you want to come in here? What did you say? If Matthew is still connected or... Why are you laughing? Okay. It's possible you have 1,000 things to do. I also work on my computer, so another I'll never do my work. And I multitask, and sometimes things slip through me, other times, but I'm used to it now. So, you know, it's human. Okay, go ahead. Let me not hold the meeting up.
Sure.
What did you say? Well, was it you? Yeah. Okay.
No, I suspect it was me. I was probably the guilty one. I mean, there
what's
has been
guilty about that. Information.
No, I think there has been positive discussions, Chair. You know, with Department of Social Development. But I think the time when we must have talked, it must have been journalist discussions. But since that time, it's kind of been parked. If I can be a little bit crude, in abeyance. DSD was meant to come back to us. I think what made it a bit difficult for us, Chair, that I think was at least last year, around September, give or take, after the NELEC engagements had kind of concluded, DSD then came with a white paper, if I get the term right, on it, and then it contained quite a few provisions we hadn't had sight of at NELEC. And that put us in quite a difficult spot because they talked about some, we felt, quite drastic taxation proposals. But they then kind of pulled it back and said they were going to come back to that like with a new paper, but we haven't heard from them since. But I think also, Chair, we would want to have engagement with government, which has both DSD and Treasury, because obviously DSD will set the policy framework. Treasury must also say what's available in the fiscus and how to fund it, etc. I think maybe it might be difficult now because of elections, but we would hope those discussions would come again. And I think which I would agree with you about having a comprehensive discussion about bringing all the different social grant elements to see what can you do from administrative efficiency, etc. But we had felt, Chair, and I'll keep quiet, and perhaps events are overtaking us to an extent, that the COVID-19 SOD grant really helped to give a foundation with all of its imperfections to a basic income grant. And we should be seeing how can we use that to kind of get the foot in the door, and how can we build upon successes, etc. But we didn't think that the kind of figures presented by Treasury were necessarily, maybe not the right term, correct. We think you could have an affordable approach to it, which would not bankrupt the fiscus, which obviously we wouldn't want to do, but at the same time, to give relief to those who need it. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, back to you, Mampu. Is there anything else you want to add on this issue before we move on to your response to other issues?
Just the last response, Chairperson, on the language or the differences in the Malinuitu account for this. I'll just ask the budget office to please quickly just respond to it.
Okay, thanks, Mampo. Let me just switch on my... Okay, so good morning, honorable members and everybody in the meeting. So I will be taking the question on the Section 70 and payments of financial assets, whether the expenditure is recorded as such in the financial system. So as you would know, that there is the reference guide to the economic classification that guides classification. And also in the appropriation bill, there are sort of definitions that are covered that covers all the categories of classification. So Section 70, it just governs how the allocation of funds directly from the National Revenue Fund, as opposed to coming from the voted funds that goes to departmental allocations. So ultimately, all those direct charges, voted funds, they do ultimately go through the spending. And they are captured in the financial system as payments for as transactions in assets and liabilities, because yes, in fact, they are recapitalization, and that's where government records the recapitalization of public entities or any other recapitalization that government undertakes. So as I've said, the Section 70 are just direct charges as required by PFMA or as legislated in terms of the PFMA Act. I think I've covered everything to that. Like I said, they do ultimately come out as expenditure. It's just that as opposed to it being voted funds, they will go as direct charges against the NRF, which is the National Revenue Fund. Thanks.
Thanks,
Wilson.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I think we note the comments that you've made, and when we have engagements with our ministers, we will bring some of the comments to their attention. And hopefully they'll take them into consideration as we get into the next budget process. Thanks, Chairperson.
All right, response to other issues raised by other members?
Okay. The response, Randan, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, MM, and it's me. Once more, Chair, I just want to deal with the question raised by Honorable Ockham regarding Section 38 NPA appointments. The amount is 750 million. Thanks.
Chair, I think we covered the responses that we had to make.
All right. Is there anybody who feels they want to follow up or it was incomplete, the response? Responses? Nope. Okay, let's move to the next one. Eskom, vote, please. Who's first? Mampo?
Dr. Peter Sewulti.
Thanks, Mampo. Morning, Chair and Honourable Members. Duncan Peters here. Chair Mike, I'm responsible for the Asset and Liability Management Division at the Treasury. My colleague Ravesh will take us through the presentation. I believe either Nokwanda or someone on your side will be flighting the presentation on our behalf. So as soon as it's up on the screen, Ravesh will take us through. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Peterson. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. My name is Ravesh Rajal from the Assets and Liability Management Divisions, and I'll just take you through Treasury's responses to the public submissions on the ESCOM debt relief bill. Okay, thanks, Nkwande. If we can move to the next slide. Chair and Honorable Members, I think just in terms of the background, we just wanted to raise the point that you would recall that the Minister of Finance introduced the bill in Parliament on the 22nd of Feb, which is a key step in ensuring that we address the financial and operational challenges by ESCOM. The Minister of Finance also did mention in the October MTBBS 2022 that Treasury will be introducing a debt relief arrangement, and this is basically the outcome of the work that has been done, and hence the bill now has been introduced, and it's the key intent of the bill is to ensure that we support ESCOM in dealing with its debt obligations and associated finance costs. There were public hearings that were conducted in April and May at SCOA and SECOA, which allowed the public and interested stakeholders to provide comments before we process the bill. And we note the comments that were made by the various stakeholders, which included the Financial and Fiscal Commission, the Parliamentary Budget Office, the Mineral Council of South Africa, Mr. B. Cronin, Nedbank, you've got COSATU, and also Dear South Africa. These comments are quite important for us as a Treasury because it will definitely assist in enriching the debt relief arrangement, more so in terms of the conditions, which, as you know, are provisional, will also help to strengthen that and ensure that that when the proposed debt relief period ends, that ESCOM returns to financial sustainability without relying further on the fiscus for bailouts. If we can move to the next slide, Nkwande. So, Chair, just in terms of how we looked at the various comments, we've basically segregated them into firstly, the overall general comments that were posed by the seven stakeholders, which basically focus on the poor financial situation of ESCOM despite the continued fiscal support over the years. And the fact that the stakeholders believe that ESCOM has been acting with impunity and also continues to pass high costs to end users, which has negatively impacted on business and municipalities, and that that any financial assistance that's provided without addressing the structural and governance problems, corruption, malfeasance, the inefficiencies and industry-wide issues will do very little to turn ESCOM around. And I think the other key comment was around that the debt relief is being implemented without a larger plan for ESCOM, not only for ESCOM, but also the South African electricity industry. And I think the other key points that was mentioned in terms of general comments was around the unbundling of ESCOM, that this would not solve the ESCOM's or the country's, electricity challenges, and rather that the entire ESCOM or certain parts of the business must be sold or concessioned to the private sector or to be operated by public-private partnerships. And then lastly, the key matter around the fact that the law enforcement in organs have not been playing their part to tackle the criminality and corruption crippling it. If we move to the next slide, then we go into the specific comments. And here, one of the comments was around the amending of Section 2B of the bill. Now, Section 2B of the bill deals with the minister in terms of his right to impose conditions in terms of the conversion of the debt from a loan into equity. And I think the key comment here was that this is excessively broad in terms of the powers that have been given to to the minister, and that it undermines the lawfulness of the proposed statute, and that the conditions basically should be connected to the central purpose of the envisaged statute, which is basically debt relief, and that the sole discretion of the minister determined conditions or the conversion of the loan needs to consider other factors. The other specific comment that was raised was around the silence on the role of the new Minister of Electricity. That is not highlighted, and the bill seems to preempt or encroach some of the proposals that the Minister of Electricity will make to Cabinet. The other specific comment was just clarity around the debt takeover of 70 billion in 2025-26. And what impact that will have on Eskom's lenders. And then the other comment specifically was this around the proposal to remove the conditions which prohibit Eskom from investing in new generation capacity and attempts to preempt and undermine the collective bargaining by the conditions attached to the wage negotiations in the bill. And then the last point was just specifically on measures specifically to address the ever-increasing municipal debt owed to Eskom. So that's an overview of the general comments and the specific comments. In the next slide, we basically take you through our approach in terms of how we went about in developing the bill and also the conditions and how it was actually structured. Now, we do recognize that while there has been billions of rands that has been spent to support Eskom, more recently, obviously, with the support package, the 230 billion support package, of which I think 157 has been executed and dispersed to Eskom, there have been limited improvements in the reliability of the electricity supply or the financial health of the company. So I think that's one of the key issues that we have taken into account when dealing with the debt relief arrangement. Now, the new approach basically is meant to strengthen the balance sheet of the utility. So it basically focuses on its ability then to restructure, which is part of the unbundling, which we'll get into the next slide. But also that the entity also focuses on undertaking the investment and maintenance needed to support the security of electricity supply. Now, the approach also allows Eskom to focus on plant performance, capital investments, and ensure that it no longer relies on further government bailouts, and also addressing the operational challenges, as it's also now going to be accompanied, as we all know, by the independent assessment of Eskom's coal fleet by the international experts, which is led by VGBE, which is the consortium. And then furthermore, in terms of the fact that, with the previous bailouts, with those funds that have been used to settle debt and interest, what we've seen is that Eskom has not been able to then manage its debt profile, and it then managed to basically incur more debt. And we sit with a situation at the point of, debt of 400 billion. So now the approach as well is to also look at the debt relief while also, will also help to improve the financial position. We also need to look at how do we then ensure that it doesn't incur further debt. So hence, we need to ensure that we also restrict their borrowings going forward for the next 3 years, and also to ensure that that it focuses on specifically looking at its internal cash generated. So basically, the funds that it will save in terms of it being used to service the debt, it will then be used to basically service, other internal, operations and also maintenance capex, and transmission and distribution. I think the previous conditions as well that were attached were operational. So hence the approach now is slightly different, where it will not be operational, but it will be focused on purely ensuring that we don't have a situation where we have further bailouts, and hence that change in approach. On this slide, basically, we are looking at the policy environment, because there were a lot of questions specifically around the policy, around the unbundling and so forth. So in terms of the approach as well, Treasury also looked at the developments that are happening in the energy sector and also around the amendments of the ERA. And we've also taken that into account. We've also engaged with DMRE through the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill, and also focusing a lot also on the municipal debt matters as well, which also will be addressed in the ERA. Treasury is also working with the National Energy Crisis Committee to resolve some of the current electricity supply challenges, and also around the broader structural challenges to the electricity sector, so that we ensure that there is availability of electricity supply. Just to also reaffirm, and just to allay any concerns, is that the bill is not in contradiction with the present unbundling process that is underway at Eskom. In fact, it actually helps to complement the unbundling process, as the Treasury also plays a key role in this unbundling process with the lenders, and to ensure that before the unbundling process is finalized, that the balance sheet of Eskom is cleaned up through the debt relief. Also, and this will help with the new balance sheets of the new 3C entities, generation, transmission, and distribution. We are working closely with Eskom on the national transmission company of South Africa. So I think there's a lot of work that's been done there as well, in terms of also ensuring that while Eskom focuses on transmission, but also that we allow the private sector to assist. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be the privatization of NTSA. Instead, it's aimed at unlocking further funding to accelerate the much needed investment in the transmission business, to connect additional capacity being procured by the DMRE. Move to the next slide. Then the clarity on the conditions, because there were a few questions just around the conditions itself. So just around the main objective of the restrictions on the new capital expenditure is just to strengthen Eskom's balance sheet during the debt relief period, which enables them to become self-sufficient and not rely on further government support for financial sustainability. So we're just ensuring that it focuses on key capital expenditure, and that it also then frees up its cash to basically focus on the key capex, as we've outlined: transmission, distribution, and maintenance capex, and also to ensure that it improves its energy availability factor, which also assists in reducing load shedding. And then we'd also that it
recording in progress.
So this is not to undermine collective bargaining and does not preempt the outcome of the wage negotiations, but it ensures that Eskom is financially self-sufficient. And I think the key point as well, amongst others, is that the debt relief can only be used to settle debt and interest payments and nothing else. So it's not meant to be used for operational purposes. It's only meant to be used to settle debt and interest payments. So on a monthly basis. We will get a profile of debt and interest payments that need to be settled, and then we will use that to settle the interest payments via the loan that will come through from the National Treasury. And then lastly, just the clarity on the debt takeover and the municipal debt. The details regarding the 70 billion debt takeover in 2025-26 will only be made public closer to the time. It's due to the sensitive nature of the transaction. Some of the debt is also traded, and that further lender engagement will be undertaken with the concerned parties. So at this stage, it's a bit premature to indicate the type of instruments that will be considered and the approach adopted. We also want to stress and highlight that Treasury has also released a explanatory note that was published on the website on the 8th of May, which also outlines further details and terms and conditions of the debt relief arrangement, because there were quite a few questions, I think, just around some of the technicalities, and the explanatory note also deals with that. And then lastly, around the municipal debt, there's also been a circular that's been published by our Intergovernmental Relations Division on the website, which also deals with the debt owed by municipalities to Eskom. And I know that there's a work at the moment that's actually currently underway with the IGR team, with COCTA and SALGA, just around ensuring that the municipalities prepare their applications to be forwarded for consideration for the Munich debt relief as well. Chair, I think that's all from my side, and I'll hand over to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, members, who's up for questions? I don't see anybody, Lubala.
Okay. I'm not sure whether it's a thumb up. There's no hand up, Chairperson.
Oh, really? Oh, all right. Do any of the stakeholders want to respond? Any of the stakeholders to whom this response was offered, do you want to say anything? I don't see anybody. Ah, Matthew Kosatu. Rob Hutchinson is happy with the response. Yeah, it's only Matthew, yeah.
Sure. If I can just jump in quickly, Chair. I mean, so I appreciate the response, on the Eskom debt relief bill. We're very happy as COSATU to have the debt relief package given to Eskom. We raised it first in 2019. So please, the governors, move forward. And we also appreciate that it's a huge relief. The fiscus can't sustain all the time. We think it will give some space to Eskom. We hope to focus on maintenance, et cetera. But we were concerned on 4 points, Chair, some of which we agreed with Treasury, some of which we didn't agree. We didn't think it made sense to say to Eskom, you can't invest in new generation capacity as part of the debt relief conditions for the time being. Eskom is in a crisis because its infrastructure just simply is aging. It's 50, 40 years, 60 years, 70 years, et cetera. And it's very expensive to maintain, and hence it's tripping all the time. There's now been an Eskom NERSA application for gas generation capacity of 3,000 megawatts, but now they're having to look how can they do it through the back door because of the debt conditions. The conditions also said that it's conditional upon the 18.65% increase in the electricity tariff hike this year, the 12% plus increase next year. And this is the first time we had such double-digit tariff hikes. You could say, sure, extenuating circumstances may necessitate. But Chair, we've been having this discussion of double-digit tariff hikes since 2006. And every year we are told by Eskom, this is a pain medication for just 1 or 3 years. And then it'll be fine. We'll be in a cost-reflective regime, et cetera. 17 years later, Chair, we're having the same discussion. A child would have gone to university in that stage from being born. And of course, the cost-reflective argument is a bit disingenuous from Eskom's side, Chair, when in essence, we are subsidizing endemic corruption, wasteful expenditure on it. And it's fine for Treasury to say they're working with Eskom supply chain management, but we don't see the rands and cents of how are they helping them to save money. But yet you've had Eskom management complaining time and again that law enforcement is really to be found wanting ESCOM's front in terms of assisting it to tackle endemic corruption and criminality. Chair, on the municipal debt thing, it's positive. And, you know, you remember that the previous Minister of Finance, Tito Mboweni, had made very, you know, loud commitments that we're going to tackle, the Treasury is going to tackle the debt issue of municipalities. It was then about 40 billion rand. It's now flirting with 60 billion rand. And we just don't see any practical action. It's really largely confined to about 41 municipalities. But we agree with Treasury. But again, we want to see action from COGTA and SALCA about moving customers, all customers, to prepaid. That's going to be a critical model. But also, I think, Chair, you would know far more than I would know that many municipalities depend upon electricity tariffs to subsidize, to cross-subsidize other services. So it is going to necessitate some sort of discussion about a new local government model, because we can't simply, you know, rob ESCOM to subsidize other things. It's not sustainable. But yeah, I think that's it from my side, Chair, but thanks very much.
All right, who else amongst the stakeholders? Willie, you remember? Yeah, okay. But let's just quickly look at the stakeholders, because we can also develop a wider understanding of some of the issues. I don't see anybody else, eh? Okay, Willie, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, you must please excuse me. I really have problems with my connectivity today.
Yeah, no, I got cut off, by the way, colleagues, for about 2 minutes. I don't know what happened, and then I missed some of it. So I lost the chat section from the original side. So I meant to say that, Willie, you reminded me, if there are things that members put in the chat who are stakeholders and or MPs, well, go ahead and raise it now verbally if it has been responded to. But go ahead, Willie. Thank you.
Thank you, Eunice. Chairperson, yeah, if I've missed it, please excuse me for that. It was also brought up by Mr. Parks now. The problem that we've got with municipalities, that they obviously rely on a certain percentage of the income that they get from the payment of electricity. But what we often see, and actually far more often than not, is that municipalities use the income that they get from paying customers for the electricity, they use that income to pay other stuff and salaries and vehicles, etc., and does not pay it over to ESCOM. The question was raised in our meeting last week. I raised the question with regards to ring fencing. How can we implement ring fencing in such a way that the municipalities will still be able to get their portion or their markup for dishing out the electricity on behalf of ESCOM, but make sure that ESCOM receives the money that they must get, and that the money that is paid by customers for electricity actually goes for electricity and not for something else. I think that is one of the main reasons why the municipalities are owing such a huge debt to ESCOM, and we can't expect from ESCOM to operate properly if they don't get the money from owed to them by municipality. So if I can just get clarity on that, I would appreciate it. I'm not going to go into all the other stuff that was mentioned last week with regards to privatization, etc. I don't think it will serve any purpose now, but I think we should, from our side, try to put as much pressure on all the entities that we ensure that ESCOM gets the money that they are owed. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, you know, most of the questions I wanted to raise have been raised already, so I'll just, in like a shorthand way, raise it. So first, let's pick up what Willie said, right? So that's the same question I wanted to ask. I see Mr. Park, as it's now called, also raised it. That is a key thing. So two aspects to it, obviously. Well, more than two, but just two that I can think of is obviously covered, but just to reemphasize, one is the issue of the surcharge, as we call it, that ESCOM uses to secure. I mean, the municipalities use the electricity they get from ESCOM to secure profit. But Willie's right. We've been saying it as well as the ANC for years and years and years, frankly, and others, that, you know, it's not being used for what it should be. It's used for the things that he said. When I was DM of COGTA, that was a big issue. We engaged with your then Deputy Minister Lene about it. Thirdly, I don't want you to say about ring fencing, but you know what? It's beginning to fade.
you know, in my appreciation of what you say, Momo is vigorously opposed to it, as is Yanga and others of you. But you know what? And I realize all that you say, the difficulties about ring fencing and what actually happens and blah, blah, blah. But I'm not convinced anymore, really. And as I look at the dire state we're in this particular case, ESCOM, I'm not convinced, really. I don't have enough of the technical competence to reply to you in a coherent way. I hope that Poppy, I don't know if she's still on study leave or Esther will help us with that in due course. But I think that's the one aspect. The other aspect is, what is going to happen now, Mampu? It's not a question you can answer. It's not fair to ask you, but because you interact with the relevant officials from the different departments, you may be able to offer us more insight than what we get through the newspaper and our previous exchanges with yourselves and others. It's that enormous debt, starting with national departments where you have some sort of leverage in treasury. Years and years and years ago, deep in ancient history, I remember raising this on the 30-day thing. Why can't treasury, when it gives its allocations of equitable share to provinces and local government municipalities, why can't it take off the slice that is owed to small businesses, as we are destroying them by not paying them within 30 days? And we've never won on that one. Treasury comes with one or other argument, it's unconstitutional, so we have to tell them. It's a roundabout argument. New MPs who come in from this group, when you come in next year, you mustn't give up on this. You see, Mampu, this roundabout argument, I don't want to bore the committee, right? But it's going on and on and on. But you know what? Really, if need be, let's change the constitution. If need be, let's change the legislation. Who shaped the constitution, if not us? We don't do it lightly. But we didn't anticipate all these things in 1996, did we? So really, you can have a change to the constitution if there's a constitutional provision that prevents you. Secondly, if it's a legislative thing, then change it. Why can't we change it? Thirdly, there are issues that may arise, and the municipalities are already making lots of noise every now and then. Selga, I think, does that. But hey, what you guys are planning here at national level ain't going to work because it's unconstitutional. Electricity is our responsibility, blah, blah, blah. Right? Not that they're able to maintain the infrastructure or deliver. I mean, in my municipality, beyond load shedding, we have every now and then, sometimes for days, what they call load reduction. Load reduction. What's the difference to average residents, whether it's load reduction or load shedding? The effect is the same. Load reduction would mean that, you know, maybe you can't put on more than a few devices. That's a reduction. But the effect in my house, and I can manage a middle class, okay? What about poor people? What about small businesses? The effect of load reduction is a blackout, so to speak. You can't have no access to electricity. I don't know what the term is. Obviously, I know the local mayor, deputy mayor, and others, and I needle them now and then when I bump into them. They just laugh, because what can they say, poor comrades? I mean, there's no answer to it. All I'm saying is, you get that all the time, okay? So let's get real, right? We really have to do something about this, Mampu. I'm not saying I'm heaping it on you, it's not fair, but the committee needs to develop positions on this. Gubabalo, I'm talking about Esther and Poppy. No. It's actually quite global, and I forgot it's Yolanda. I'm not sure who the researcher is, the boss of the team. And you coordinate them as a committee secretary to itself. So, you know, you have to help us on this issue for the in preparation for our exit report and so on. I think these issues should be put on the agenda. But hey, that's just my view. The majority must agree, particularly when the chair of the committee is here. Okay, then the next issue I wanted to raise, look, they're covered by Matthew, actually. I really don't understand, honestly. I've been thinking about this and I thought I would one day raise it, but I wasn't here last week. I would have raised it last week. What is the rationale? I don't fully understand. I hear you, and I read it sometime in the media, but I don't fully understand. What is the rationale of saying you accept this relief from the state, financial relief, provided you don't invest in new generation? I don't understand that one. If you're investing in new generation, isn't partly the argument, well, I'm not sure I've got this right. The state will assist ESCOM because we have no choice, right? Even though our budget is stressed, we're helping them out, right? Okay, we accept that has to be done. But then, surely that helps them to go to the markets to raise the money to invest in new generation. As Betty rightly points out, you can do so much with the current power stations, but how much can you really do aging as they are? You can certainly get a better performance from them overall, and it's partly part of the multi-pronged strategy, right? We agree. But isn't there too much emphasis on that? I'm not a technical expert. And for what it's worth, the experts that appear on TV and elsewhere seem to say that you can't do too much. The majority say that. But then, you know, the state will say, well, these people are hostile to us politically and ideologically. You know what? I don't care. It's a technical argument mainly. And that's what we need to know. Ideologically, the issue is we can't hand over a basic service like electricity to the private sector. We don't agree with other parties that say, but what we do say, and we said it before, and it's very boring, Mampu, and I think I've said it 20,000 times this year, a series of public-private partnerships and private sector involvement in a variety of forms, other than handing over a basic service like electricity to the private sector. And there are thousands of, to have a hyperbole, using exaggeration, there could be thousands of ways of getting private sector participation. They secure the profits, but they also serve our developmental goals. By the way, it's also serving their profit goals, because if the electricity gets cut off, they themselves are in financial trouble. Okay, over to you, Mampu. I've got very little to say. I dragged on for nothing. The two previous speakers covered those issues, but I felt I should say something because, well, I don't know why I felt that, but Mampu, go ahead, please.
Chair, I will come in. Duncan Peters here.
Yes, of course. You're managing this part. Yes, sorry.
Yes, exactly. Yes. No. Thanks.
Sorry about that.
So Chair, on the two issues raised, let me offer some responses. Let me start with the municipal debt issue, and you are correct. The bulk of this is driven by a handful of municipalities. The way we've attempted to respond to this, and Ravesh made this point, is that we did issue a few weeks ago a new MFMA, a new municipal circular, for participating municipalities write off the debt owed to Eskom. Benefit from the phased debt write over the next few years will need to maintain their payments to Eskom. So they will need to have updated electricity. And then there are a range of other conditions as well, Chair. They will have to table funded budgets. Their tariffs to reflect the cost of providing electricity, and so on and so forth. The key question here, Chair, is it is still unclear how many of the municipalities will take up this debt relief offer. And so our colleagues in the Intergovernmental Relations Division is engaging, obviously, with the key municipalities, the handful that are responsible for this, as well as SALGA, COCTA, and other stakeholders, to make sure that the municipalities do in fact take up this opportunity, and if they do take up the opportunity for, and of course, the underlying issues will be addressed through the conditions that the municipalities have to comply with. So that's on the municipal side, and I think, Chair, we would have to come back to this committee and other committees as well and just provide an update on what the take-up on the municipal debt relief matter has been, because that is obviously an issue of enormous interest. Secondly, Chair, on the issue of the new generation, there are really three reasons, Chair, why we are saying that for the next 3 years, Eskom should avoid new generation capital expenditure. The first reason, Chair, is that for many years now, because of the balance sheet challenges that Eskom had, they did not undertake the required capital maintenance in the existing fleet, which is why that fleet has deteriorated so significantly over the last few years. So the first point we are making is that Eskom must prioritize, and one is already starting to see that happen in the business, must prioritize the capital maintenance expenditure of its existing fleet so that we can get better performance out of the current fleet. The second reason is, Chair, as you will know and honorable members will know, a big part of the reason many of the new generation projects were not able to be connected to the grid was because there has also been a lack of investment in new transmission infrastructure. And so the other part of the conditionality says that Eskom has a limited balance sheet. They have limited resources from an engineering design, project management perspective, and they must prioritize transmission investment, both from a balance sheet perspective, but also from a human capital perspective, because otherwise we are not going to be able to cater for any of the new gigawatts that are coming online in the future. And then finally, Chair, the other reason is that new generation investment will require, as you've also indicated, new borrowing. And it is very difficult for us in an environment where we are giving a bailout to Eskom to then also allow Eskom to borrow more, because that defeats the purpose of the bailout, and that will likely mean that Eskom will be back at the fiscal authority's door a few years from now asking for additional bailouts. So unlike with previous bailouts where Eskom was allowed to continue to borrow, we are now saying Eskom cannot be allowed to borrow unless it has the permission of the Minister of Finance so that it can delever its balance sheet, restore its financial sustainability, and focus on the projects that are going to be critical for the sustainability of the grid, including including transmission and distribution infrastructure. And we are proposing this measure on new generation for the debt relief period. Of course, beyond the debt relief period, one will then have to reassess Eskom's balance sheet and its capital needs and then make a decision at that time. So I believe, Chair, those were the only two issues raised from a question point of view. If there are any further questions, we will happily respond to those as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Duncan. Yes, now, are there any responses, colleagues, comrades, friends, who's here? Any stakeholder or any MP or MPL, if you're here? There's only one thing in the chat group. What does it say? Happy with the response. I can't tell. Rob Hutchinson, yeah, he said he's happy with the response. Okay, good. You know, can I then draw the meeting to a close, Lubabalo? There's minutes, but I mean, for this part of the meeting, can we draw it to a close? Is anybody else? Does any staff member want to say anything? Nope. All right, good. Not good. Fine, let's go on. Thank you. Thanks, Treasury. Thanks to the stakeholders who are here. Mr. Parks, we thank you too, and Mr. Hutchinson and whoever else is here, who has a stake in what, well, we all have a stake, but whoever has contributed last week in the public hearings. Thank you. Bye then. Right, let's move over to the minutes, please. Can you flag the minutes, my friend, Lubabalo?
Thank you very much, Chair. With respect to minutes, Chairperson, we would like to propose that the committee defer them to the next meeting.
Yeah, I was about to suggest that.
Yes, the reason being...
Because I think I wasn't even there.
Yes, and
I don't know, I was going to ask you, okay, Mr. Advocate, is it possible for somebody to chair a meeting where he wasn't there for legitimate reasons? Okay, that's it. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Willie. No thanks to Simon Mollet. Sorry, he didn't say a word, my friend. I'm reporting it to your head. And who else spoke? thanks to, well, Matthew's not a member. Well, it's hard to say he's not a member of it because he's here so often and more than sometimes our members are. But there you are. Thank you, Lumbalo, and the team that pulled this meeting together. We shall meet next week. I think I'll be able to connect on Wednesday via virtually, depending on my confidence commitment. All right. Thank you. Bye then.
Keep well, Jay. Bye-bye.
Bye.